Winston Churchill is best known as the great wartime British Prime Minister who led his country through the Second World War, but less well known is Winston Churchill, the young officer whose ambition led him to British India, where he made a name for himself as a soldier and a war correspondent. In his book, Churchill's First War, Con Coughlin describes how Churchill found himself in a vicious fight against Pashtun tribesmen in Malakand, Afghanistan, the forefathers of today's Taliban. The CIA is making drone strikes on the very same slopes where Churchill fought in 1897. His book is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Con Coughlin to our show today. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
You write that Churchill's experiences in Malakand, but first of all, am I pronouncing your name right?
Coughlin.
It's Coughlin.
Yeah.
Okay. You're right that Churchill's experiences in Malakand, Afghanistan, are seldom mentioned in his biographies. Why do you think that period in his life is often overlooked?
Well, he was only fighting in that area for about 6 weeks. And as a result of his exploits on the Afghan border in 1897, he then went to the Sudan and took part in the charge of Omdurman. And then, of course, he went on to cover the Boer War, where he was captured, escaped from captivity, and became a household name. So in the biographies, people tend to focus on his exploits in South Africa rather than the first few weeks of his military career in Afghanistan.
But he also fought for Spain against the Cuban insurgency. All of this sounds like he saw himself as a defender of colonialism.
Well, he wasn't fighting in Cuba. He went there as a tourist, really. He was training to be a military officer at Sandhurst, the Royal Military Academy in England. And during his summer break, he wanted to see some action. And as you say, the Cuban Civil War was raging at the time. And he thought he'd just go and have a look at it, see what war was really like. What's interesting, actually, and it's something the New York Press picked up on at the time, is that he basically had a request from the British military to draw some maps of the battleground. So effectively, he went as a spy. And when he came back to New York to catch the boat back home to Britain, he was ambushed by some American reporters who put this to him and said, you know, you're really a British spy. And he got very indignant. He's only 21, but there was this great sort of standoff on the dock in New York with young Winston berating these pesky reporters.
Even though he was.
Even though he was, yeah.
Where is Malakand? You don't hear that name today in reports from Afghanistan.
Well, Malakand is in the heart of what we now know as the tribal areas of Pakistan. And its significance was that the British, to guard the British Empire, and of course Pakistan was part of the British Empire, northern India, and to guard the northern outpost of the British Empire, they built a series of forts, Malakand being one of them, to keep the Afghan tribesmen at bay. And significantly, one of the big supply depots for these forts was called Abbottabad, which most of your listeners will know is the place where Mr. Bin Laden met his mate a few years ago.
So the British Army was fighting the same people who the U.S. and the Pakistani Army are fighting today?
Yeah. I mean, it's a complicated picture because the Pashtun tribesmen inhabit basically both sides of the mountain ranges of what is now Pakistan and Afghanistan. And from 2001, when U.S. forces first went into Afghanistan and fought the Taliban, a lot of these tribesmen, the Taliban, of course, come from the Pashtun tribes, they were pushed over the border into Pakistan. And so as a result of that, a lot of the CIA drone strikes now taking place are taking place against exactly the same tribes, villages and valleys where Churchill fought as a 22-year-old in 1897.
And how successful were the British in those battles?
I think we had the same sort of mixed results that the modern campaign had. Churchill went into the campaign in a very gung-ho spirit. One of his most famous quotes, "Nothing is more exhilarating in life than to be shot at without result," comes from that period. He was typical of his generation.
But he seems to be incredibly ambitious.
He was very
ambitious. Is that the result of growing up in the family he grew up in?
Well, of course, you know, the Churchill dynasty was one of the great martial dynasties in Britain. the first John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough, made a great name for himself fighting in the early 18th century. And Churchill was very much aware that he had been born into this martial dynasty. And as a young man, his own family fortunes were rather perilous. His father had died of syphilis. His mother was something of a social courtesan. The family finances were virtually bankrupt. So he needed to make a name for himself. And he thought a military career was the perfect training for life in politics, because even at this stage, his eye was being on a... he wants to be a great politician.
Well, his father had been a successful politician until he deteriorated.
Yeah, Lord Randolph had been one of the great rising stars of the British Conservative Party, and had become the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the man who run the money man in the government, until he had a spectacular falling out with the then Prime Minister. And then, as I said, he contracted syphilis, so he had this rather painful last few years of his life where, as one of his contemporaries once remarked, he died by inches in public. He sort of lost his marbles, basically.
Did Churchill's father influence his decision to leave England for India?
No. Churchill's father was very indifferent to his son's exploits. In fact, young Winston had a very neglected childhood. And reading his sort of diaries from this period, he's clearly determined to sort of try and make amends for this neglect, to show both his family and the wider world that he has something to offer.
And didn't most young men who were ambitious wind up going to India?
I think if you're a young military officer, India was a good place to go. It was a remote outpost of empire, but there was always some kind of military action taking place, most often on the Afghan border, if not inside Afghanistan itself.
But he went to Bangalore first.
Well, his regiment, much to his irritation, was initially posted right to the down to southern India, as far away from the action as you could get. And you get this sense of his desire to be at the heart of the action, because while the rest of his fellow officers were indulging in pursuits such as pig-sticking and tiger hunting, he was agitating to get moved north to where the action was so he could see some action.
On the other hand, this was an opportunity for him to self-educate.
Well, yes. He'd been a very indifferent pupil at school. And once he got into the army was the making of him. He just scrambled into Sandhurst, but once there, he excelled. And from the moment he put on his uniform, he realised that he had to make up for his missed education and became an autodidact and read up on Macaulay, Gibbon, his father's speeches, and was really had a sort of crash course in self-education.
How did he wind up being sent to Malakand?
Well, he had basically through a family friend, the brilliantly named British general Sir Bindon Blood. And General Blood basically made a promise to young Winston at a family gathering that if there was any more trouble with the tribes, he would get Churchill on his staff. And sure enough, in 1897, because the British were building this fort as a defensive measure, the tribes revolted in that region, thinking that the British were coming to change their way of life, and Churchill was called for to come up and support the mission.
Do any of the forts survive today? You were there, weren't you,
when you researched
the book?
When I was researching the book, I persuaded the Pakistani military to take me to Malakand. Of course, Malakand is now right in the heart of the modern campaign and is a main military base of the Pakistanis, who were not happy to have me there. And in fact, when I got into the compound and I saw Churchill's room where he wrote his first war dispatches, I noticed there was an early warning aircraft system in the compound, and I asked the Pakistani commander what it was. And it was just after the Bin Laden affair in Abbottabad nearby, and they told me that's to sort of basically spot low-flying American helicopters in case there were any other U.S. Navy SEAL missions taking place in Pakistan.
My guest is Con Coughlin, executive foreign editor of The Daily Telegraph, an expert on the Middle East and author of several books on it. His latest is called Churchill's First War, Young Winston at War with the Afghans. You probably are aware of his role in the Boer War, but this preceded the Boer War, and I'm assuming led him eventually to think of going to Africa. Did his participation in this campaign help him in his future political life?
Well, the thesis of the book is that this was this war, Churchill's first war, was the making of him, because until he went to Afghanistan, nobody was really very much aware of him. But he fought with distinction. He nearly got himself killed during the 6 weeks he was fighting. And he wrote his first book, The Malakan Field Force, as a result of his exploits. And as a result of that, he got to meet the Prime Minister of the day, Lord Salisbury, and made his first visit to Downing Street. So his career can really be seen to take off from this time.
Well, do you think that he gained more notoriety from his military exploits or his writing about it?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think it was really the writing that got noticed, because he wrote some dispatches for my newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, and he wrote a book, and it was the correspondence that was picked up by people like the Prince of Wales at the time, by the Prime Minister, and it brought him to public attention. He did actually win a mention in dispatches for his bravery in one engagement, but it was the writing that got him noticed.
Was that a common thing for somebody to be both a military man and a foreign correspondent, in effect?
Well, in the 1890s, Fleet Street in London, the home of the British newspaper industry, had struck up this rather convenient alliance with the British military, where rather than sending foreign correspondents to cover wars with all the great expense involved, they would get young officers to write dispatches. And one of Churchill's contemporaries, who won the Victoria Cross, Fincastle, wrote for the Times. And in fact, this practice lasted until young Winston started writing his articles. And Lord Kitchener, the commander of British forces in the region, took such exception to young Churchill's open criticism of the conduct of the campaign that he banned the practice. And so from then on, Fleet Street had to pay its own expenses.
So this helped him achieve his own personal goals, but at the same time, he was rather pessimistic about the outcome of the Malakan campaign.
Yes, well, I said he set off at the start with a very sort of gung-ho attitude that the might of the British Empire would be more than a match for these primitive tribesmen. And after 6 weeks of very intense fighting, the fighting at times was so intense that Churchill and the Afghans were throwing rocks at each other when the bullets ran out. And after that experience and seeing his friends killed and mutilated, it was a very chastening experience. And he realised that, first of all, war was a very unpleasant experience, and this stayed with him for the rest of his life and affected his conduct as a war leader. But also, so far as Afghanistan was concerned, he sort of basically reached the conclusion you're never going to really beat them by force of arms. And I think that's what's echoed through the decades to the modern campaign.
Do you think that any American military officers read the story of the Malakan Field Force?
Well, in fact, I got the idea to write this book from General David Petraeus, who, when he was drawing up his own counterinsurgency program to defeat the Taliban, had reread the Malakan Field Force. And he said, what we're trying to do is not that different from what the Brits did in the 19th century. And I fear that we might end up with the same result.
Well, it seems that we have. Do you see many parallels between the British Empire's experience in Afghanistan, Pakistan in the 19th century and the Soviet war from 79 to 89, or the United States experience over the past dozen years?
Well, I think what the one lesson you can learn from reading Churchill, from looking at the Soviet experience and our more recent experience as part of the NATO mission, is there's not a military solution to this campaign. Even David Petraeus, when he was commanding forces in Afghanistan, said there is no military solution. The military can apply pressure to bring people to the conference table, but ultimately you've got to resolve this politically. The British did actually resolve it politically in 1901 when Lord Curzon negotiated separate deals with the various tribes. And that deal lasted right up until 2001. The problem I fear with the current withdrawal strategy is we're leaving without any political settlement in place.
Well, it's a little more difficult today when you had Hamid Karzai leading the Afghan side, and then you have the Taliban promising to participate in talks and then killing a whole bunch of people on the day that the talks are about to start, it leads to it makes it almost impossible to actually get anything done. I mean, how can you trust the Taliban, who are pretty much the same people that Churchill was fighting?
Yeah, well, they are. But let's remember that the Taliban come from the Pashtun community. The Pashtun tribes are 20 million strong.
Would it be a better idea to actually create a country called Pashto?
Well, that has been sort of a bit like Kurdistan. People have said, let's have a separate state for the Pashtuns. It hasn't happened, not least because the Pashtuns had a very good deal in modern Pakistan with the great autonomy they had. But there are tribes within tribes, and if you really want to sort of deal with the Taliban, you have to identify those elements within the movement that actually want a peace treaty and what are known as the irreconcilables, the crowd around Mullah Omar, which don't want to deal with the West at any price. But my fear is that no political effort is even being applied in that area, so we're going to leave with this mission unfulfilled.
Well, one of the attempts was to win over the hearts and minds of the people as one of the solutions, but that doesn't seem to have worked either.
Well, the fundamental problem with the Hearts and Minds campaign is that we started, and we have done, I go to Afghanistan regularly, and we have done a lot of good work. And if in certain areas of the country, there's a lot more freedom, a lot of people are very grateful for what we've done and the sacrifices we've made, both in terms of blood and treasure over the last decade or so, their concern is that we're leaving, just like the Soviets left. And we're not giving very much guarantees for their security in the future. And that, to my mind, explains the rather bizarre behavior by President Karzai at the moment, who just feels he's been abandoned.
Well, after the Soviets left, there was a lot of fighting between the various warlords, and the Taliban were almost greeted as saviors, as stabilizers. And it was only later that we realized what a big mistake that was. But don't we see pretty much the same thing happening again?
It all depends on whether the Afghan security forces that we've spent a lot of money and effort training, the Afghan army, the Afghan police, which are now 300,000 strong, and at the moment they're doing quite good work, but they do quite good work because the British and the Americans and others are still there to support them with helicopters, intelligence, to guide them. And the fear is that if we're not there post-2014 to provide similar kinds of support, and this whole issue is still under negotiation with Kabul, that they will disintegrate, and then you will have the chaos that we had following the Soviet withdrawal and the inevitable return of the Taliban, which I don't think would be good for anyone.
Con Coughlin's the executive foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph, and his latest book is Churchill's First War, Young Winston at War with the Afghans. It is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.